Welcome to New World Notes, a series that explores the gap between the America we want and the America they're trying to make us settle for, and how we the people can reestablish our commonwealth and reclaim our democracy. Edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust.
For each of the past two shows, we've read a section of an article on Israel's attack on the USS Liberty. Using that as a starting point, we've meandered around current events and recent history, noting the parallels and connections. That's one way New World Notes differs from the Fox Dimwitness News. TV news and newspapers, too, present events as unconnected. Unconnected one to another, unconnected to any larger historical forces. Of course, some connections are simply dumb and misleading. There's a prep school-educated cowboy with a Yale diploma who would like you to imagine a connection between 9/11 and the country of Iraq. He would certainly not like you to imagine a connection between 9/11 and that bastion of democracy, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. He would also like you to imagine a connection between the capitalist conquest of Iraq and the goal of bringing democracy to the Middle East. He would not like you to imagine a connection between the conquest of Iraq and the U.S. overthrow of Iraq's democratically elected government in 1958. What's that? Nobody told you Iraq had a democratic government in 1958 and that we overthrew it? It must have been in all the papers in 2003. U.S. overthrows Iraqi government for second time in 45 years. No? ABC News forgot to mention it too? Sorry about the cheap sarcasm. I had no idea of it myself until very recently. Same for the U.S.'s overthrow of the staunchly pro-American democratic government of Iran in 1953. So, a toast to Cowboy W. and his half-dozen predecessors soiling the Oval Office for doing so much to bring theocracy to the Middle East. We better knock off these connections, however illuminating, or we will never find out why Israel did its best to sink the Navy spy ship, the USS Liberty, as it floated in the eastern Mediterranean, 13 miles off the coast of Egypt, during the so-called Six-Day War of 1967, and why the U.S. government tried so hard to cover up the incident. We are going to finish this terrific article today, or the public affairs director is going to do something to me that I think is anatomically impossible, but why take chances? It's by Jeffrey St. Clair. The title is Israel's Attack on the USS Liberty Revisited. The blurb above that says, Rockets, Napalm, Torpedoes, and Lie, L-I-E. We've read two-thirds of it over the past 2 weeks. Two short sections remain. I call these sections The Navy and the Lobby Strike Back, and last, Why Did They Do It? How tightly does the Israel lobby control Capitol Hill? For the first time in history, an attack on an American ship was not subjected to a public investigation by Congress. First time in history. In 1980, Adlai Stevenson and Barry Goldwater planned to open a Senate hearing into the Liberty affair. Then Jimmy Carter intervened by brokering a deal with Menachem Begin, where Israel agreed to pony up $6 million to pay for damages to the ship. A State Department press release announcing the payment said, "The book is now closed on the USS Liberty." It certainly was the last chapter for Adlai Stevenson. He ran for governor of Illinois the following year, where his less-than-perfect record on Israel and his unsettling questions about the Liberty affair became an issue in the campaign. Somehow, big money flowed from somewhere into the coffers of his Republican opponent, Big Jim Thompson, and Stevenson went down to a narrow defeat. But the book wasn't closed for the sailors either. After a Newsweek story exposed the gist of what really happened, an enraged Admiral McCain placed all the sailors under a gag order. When one sailor told an officer that he was having problems living with the cover-up, he was told, "Forget about it. That's an order." the Navy went to bizarre lengths to keep the crew of the Liberty from telling what they knew. When gag orders didn't work, they threatened sanctions. Ennis tells of the confinement and interrogation of two Liberty sailors that sounds like something straight from the CIA's MK Ultra program. Since coming home, the veterans who have tried to tell of their ordeal have been harassed relentlessly. They've been branded as drunks, bigots, liars, and frauds. Often, it turns out, these slurs have been leaked by the Pentagon. And, oh yeah, the sailors have also been painted as anti-Semites. In a recent column, Charlie Reeve described just how mean-spirited and petty this campaign became. Quote, "When a small town in Wisconsin decided to name its library in honor of the USS Liberty crewman, a campaign claiming it was anti-Semitic was launched. And when the town went ahead, the U.S. government ordered no Navy personnel to attend, and it sent no messages. At the time, this little library was the only memorial to the men who died on the Liberty." Section 4. Why did they do it? So why, then, did the Israelis attack the Liberty? A few days before the Six-Day War, Israel's Foreign Minister Abba Eban visited Washington to inform LBJ about the forthcoming invasion. Johnson cautioned Eban that the U.S. would not support such an attack. It's possible, then, that the IDF, that's the Israel Defense Forces, the IDF assumed that the Liberty was spying on the Israeli war plans. Possible, but not likely. U.S. intelligence aid certainly helped secure Israel's swift victory. In fact, it's possible that the Liberty had been sent to the region to spy for the IDF. A somewhat more likely scenario holds that Moshe Dayan, Defense Minister of Israel, wanted to keep the lid on Israel's plan to breach the new ceasefire and invade Syria to seize the Golan. Sidebar comment, the Israelis had originally planned to invade Syria on June 8. Instead, they spent June 8 trying to destroy the USS Liberty and invaded Syria a day later on June 9. Back to St. Clair's text. There's another factor. The Liberty was positioned just off the Egyptian coast from the town of El Arish. The IDF had seized El Arish and had used the airport there as a prisoner of war camp. On the very day the Liberty was attacked, the IDF was in the process of executing as many as 1,000 Palestinian and Egyptian prisoners of war. This was a war crime that they surely wanted to conceal from prying eyes. The bigger question is why the U.S. government would participate so enthusiastically in the cover-up of a war crime against its own sailors. Well, the Pentagon has never been slow to hide its own incompetence, and there's plenty of that in the Liberty affair. Bungled communications, refusal to provide an escort, situating the defenseless Liberty too close to a raging battle, the inability to intervene in the attack, and the inexcusably long time it took to reach the battered ship and its wounded. Sidebar comment, in fact, a Russian Navy ship approached the Liberty first and offered its assistance. The captain thought it best to decline the Russian's kind offer. The first American Navy ship to reach the Liberty to offer help came fully 16 hours after the battle began, 16 hours after the Liberty was first attacked. Back to the article. All this is par for the course. But something else was going on that would only come to light later. Throughout most of the 1960s, the U.S. Congress had imposed a ban on the sale of arms to both Israel and Jordan. But at the time of the Liberty attack, the Pentagon, and its allies in the White House and on Capitol Hill, was seeking to have this proscription overturned. The top brass certainly knew that any evidence of a deliberate attack on a U.S. Navy ship by the IDF would scuttle their plans. So they hushed it up. A few months after the attack, in January 1968, the arms embargo on Israel was lifted, and the sale of American weapons began to flow. By 1971, Israel was buying $600 million of American-made weapons a year. 2 years later, the purchases topped $3 billion. Almost overnight, Israel had become the largest buyer of U.S.-made arms and aircraft. Perversely, then, the IDF's strike on the Liberty served to weld the U.S. and Israel together in a kind of political and military embrace. Now, every time the IDF attacks defenseless villages in Gaza and the West Bank with American-built F-16s and Apache helicopters, the Palestinians quite rightly see the bloody assaults as a joint operation, with the Pentagon as a hidden partner. Thus does the legacy of the Liberty live on unto this day. End of terrific article by Jeffrey St. Clair, Israel's Attack on the USS Liberty Revisited. Edited and condensed for radio by yours truly. The original is well worth reading. You can easily find it on the internet. Look up Counterpunch on the World Wide Web, issue of June 8, 2007, and read the whole thing. It's well worthwhile. And it raises many, many important questions, some of which we'll get to in a few minutes. We're going to let Roy Zimmerman take a crack at one of them first. That's the question of, what does it mean to support our troops? Who is supporting our troops? The Pentagon? The guy driving the SUV with the yellow Support Our Troops ribbon from his home to the supermarket 2 miles away? Or is it tree huggers like Jeffrey St. Clair, who are the only ones who seem to be interested in supporting our troops? Well, the question may reveal a little bias on my part, but it's an important question and one that hasn't gone away. It applied to the men of the Liberty in 1967. It applies to the men and women in our service today in Iraq. Anyway, Roy Zimmerman talks about this more eloquently than I do, so let's let him start off, and I'll come back afterwards with a couple final remarks. Hey, fellow old-timers, remember Jorma Kekkonen as in Hot Tuna? Dig the great imitation at the beginning here.
Got that yellow ribbon stuck on your H2. Thanks for the support. Memorial Day weekend, you threw a barbecue. Thanks for the support. I can feel the love 7,000 miles away. And I'm a patriot, as I was trying to say when you cut me short. Thanks for the support. I was gunning for Osama, and you sent me for Saddam. Thanks for the support. And I just sat down to dinner. It's another can of Spam. Thanks for the support. You say, complete the mission, and I say, count on me. 'Cause I don't even know what mission there might be to abort. Thanks for the support. And you sent me here a third time, and my house was repossessed. Thanks for the support. Now my wife is in a trailer, but she sent a Kevlar vest. Thanks for the support. And I think of her only every time I bleed. And someday we will meet again at Walter Reed, the resort of last resort. Thanks for the support. Those mercenaries who make 8 times what I do. Thanks for that. And you showed up on Thanksgiving with a turkey and a camera crew. Thanksgiving. Now you're giving guns to the ones who shot at me. The tank is full, but the strategy might be down a quart. Thanks to the support. And I appreciate the stopgap, and I appreciate the surge. Thanks for the support. Another 20,000 voices to harmonize this dirge. Thanks for the support. And to the Democratic Congress who could have sent me home, who must have come down with a new Gulf War syndrome of some sort. Thanks for the support. If I die tomorrow, won't you ship me home at night? Thanks for the support. And if I have a funeral, make sure it's out of sight. Thanks for the support. In the final seconds, you've got a plan to win. It's cut those taxes and let Jesus put one in from half court. Thanks for the support.
So there's the mystery of the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty, at least somewhat explained through the research efforts of people like James Ennis Jr. and the reporting efforts of writers like Jeffrey St. Clair. And there you have it. You encounter something that seems bizarre, inexplicable, a freak of nature. A half dozen new facts later, it all fits together. Alas, when clarity comes, you don't feel any better. You feel worse. On the one hand, there's the ethical system that was drummed into you by church, school, Dear Abby, Boy Scouts. You could sum it up in one sentence if you had to. As far as I can tell, every holy book in the world has a sentence like it. Here's the Christian version. Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. The Jewish version is almost exactly the same. Your so-called leaders are always gassing on about our Judeo-Christian heritage, about how they always look to God for guidance. I remember President Nixon hosting a series of what he called White House prayer breakfasts. Not just ordinary prayer breakfasts, but White House prayer breakfasts. Power prayer breakfasts. Even though Jesus of Nazareth did not have a lot to say on the subject of gay marriage, he did, very explicitly and at some length, condemn public praying. This is recorded in a couple of obscure Bible verses unknown to most American leaders. It's in one of those odd corners of the New Testament that nobody reads. In the middle of an obscure speech by Jesus, sometimes referred to as the Sermon on the Mount. You could look it up. But let's get back to the Liberty. Our pious Christian so-called leaders, and Joe Lieberman, who outdoes the Christians in public piety, our leaders certainly believe that Judeo-Christian ethics and values are what the American proletariat needs. How do you feel when you discover this? While you've been reading the book of Matthew, they've been reading the book of Machiavelli. Suppose your pension fund was heavily invested in Lockheed and other war industries. How many American sailors would you be willing to kill in order to keep Lockheed's profits high? More than 200? My best guess would be that your upper limit would be zero. President Johnson, Secretary McNamara, Admiral McCain, and many other powerful people connived in the attempted murder of 200 American servicemen, in the murder of 34 servicemen. It just occurs to me that McCain means son of Cain. Well, let's go on. They connived in the murder of 34 servicemen.
Then they conducted a massive cover-up that continues to this day. Why? To make sure a big, profitable arms sale went through. And why would Israel try their hardest to kill 200 non-combatant servicemen of their greatest ally and protector? 1. To make sure the arms sale went through. 2. To conceal the atrocious war crime they were in the process of committing, the needless slaughter of 1,000 Egyptian soldiers who had surrendered and were prisoners of war. And 3. To hide from its great ally and protector Israel's imminent next war crime, invading Syria and stealing the Golan Heights. How do you feel when you discover that obscene acts of mass slaughter are just business as usual to our pious, most Christian leaders? How many towel-headed Arabs would these devout Christians be willing to kill in order to see that ExxonMobil gets the big oil contract instead of Total of France? Plenty. How many U.S. service members are our pious leaders willing to kill to keep Lockheed profits high? Plenty. Here's a theme that's been reappearing in New World Notes over and over again, beginning with our first broadcast. Who is the greatest enemy our service members must fight against? Answer: the Pentagon. Hitler's henchmen killed 6 million innocent Jews. An obscenity beyond imagination. A Holocaust. The Holocaust. Bush and Clinton and Bush's henchmen killed, here's a conservative estimate, 2.5 million innocent Iraqis. Collateral damage. Regrettable but unavoidable. No, our pious Christian leaders didn't herd Iraqis into gas chambers. Some we incinerated, some we exploded, some we crushed under rubble. More often, though, we destroyed their electricity plants and water treatment plants and sewage treatment plants. We'd refused to let them import needed chemicals and replacement parts. We then sat back and watched the fun as they died by the thousands of dysentery and cholera. Last I heard, there was still an ongoing major cholera epidemic in the capital of Iraq, Baghdad. Some organizations are trying to discover and then record the names of all humans who have died in the Iraq-Afghanistan war and occupation. That's a worthy, if impossible, task. In May, I read the names of the 4 unarmed student war protesters who were shot and killed by the unofficial goon squad unit of the Ohio National Guard in 1970. Probably no one in America knows the names of those 1,000 Egyptian prisoners of war murdered by the Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, in the town of El Arish, Egypt, on June 8, 1967. I can give the names of the 34 U.S. Navy sailors of the USS Liberty, murdered at the same time, only 13 miles away, murdered by the IDF and the U.S. Department of Defense and President Lyndon Baines Johnson.
William P. Allenbaugh, Philip M. Armstrong, Jr., Gary R. Blanchard, Alan M. Blue, Francis Brown, Ronnie J. Campbell, Jerry L. Converse, Robert B. Eisenberg, Jerry L. Goss, Curtis L. Graves, Lawrence P. Hayden, Warren Hersey, Alan Higgins, Carl L. Hoare, Richard W. Keene, James L. Lanau, Raymond E. Lynn, James M. Lupton, Dwayne R. Margraf, David W. Marlborough, Anthony P. Mendel, Carl C. Nygren, James C. Pierce, Jack Raper, Edward Raymeyer II, David N. Skolak, John C. Smith, Jr., Melvin D. Smith, John C. Spiker, Alexander N. Thompson, Thomas R. Thornton, Philip C. Teitke, Stephen S. Toth, Frederick J. Walton.
I must take care of some business, and then one last point. New World Notes is produced in the studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. Scott Bergwin read the names of the dead U.S. sailors. The opinions expressed here do not necessarily reflect the views of anyone connected with this station or of the licensee. I am solely responsible for its content. Email to kdoust, that's K-D-O-W-S-T, at hotmail.com. This program will end with a prayer. It's not mine. In fact, I reject most of what it says. To me, this text demonstrates the wisdom of America's founders when they prohibited establishing a state church. It shows Jesus' wisdom when he forbade his followers to pray in public. This prayer is new to me, but apparently it is familiar to millions of people around the world. You can find many English translations of this prayer all over the internet. I've denounced at length texts like Battle Hymn of the Republic and Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition, obscene, blasphemous exercises in making yourself and your neighbors feel good about whatever politically motivated bloodbath our politicians have decided to set flowing. We can feel good about aiding and abetting this officially sanctioned mass slaughter, because the Lord God Almighty wants it to happen, and will see to it that we slaughter more of them than vice versa. I do not intend to single out any particular religion here. The Christians, the Jews, the Muslims, the Hindus, I'm sure all of them have standard familiar prayers just like this one. On June 8, 1977, the Israel Defense Forces were obeying the commands of Defense Minister Moshe Dayan and God to murder 1,000 defenseless Egyptian prisoners and destroy a ship of Israel's great enemy, the United States of America. And as the victims were bleeding to death, or drowning in their own blood, or drowning in seawater that came roaring through the hull, or burning to death, and as the brave pilots were machine-gunning the life rafts of the enemy's unarmed and crippled ship, the USS Liberty, back home, their parents and sweethearts and politicians and holy men were loudly reciting, loudly so God would be sure to hear it over the screams of the dying, loudly reciting this text, whose title is Prayer for the Members of the Israel Defense Forces. He who blessed our forefathers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, may he bless the fighters of the Israel Defense Forces, who stand guard over our land and the cities of our God, from the border of the Lebanon to the desert of Egypt, and from the great sea unto the approach of the wilderness of Arabah, on the land, in the air, and on the sea. May the Almighty cause the enemies who rise up against us to be struck down before them. May the Holy One, blessed is He, preserve and rescue our fighters from every trouble and distress, and from every plague and illness. And may He send blessing and success in their every endeavor. May He lead our enemies under our soldiers' sway, and may He grant our soldiers salvation and crown them with victory. And may there be fulfilled for them the verse, "For it is the Lord your God who goes with you, to battle your enemies for you, to save you." Now let us respond, Amen.